Treasury Secretary says Fannie and Freddie can never be the same.
So what should be the government's role in housing?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, August 17th. The Secretaries of Treasury and Housing are meeting today in Washington about what to do with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the miserable housing market.
Also today, hard times have Americans cutting back on their health care, and a Starbucks customer says, no, I will not use your coffee lingo. But first,
the government-backed mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been hemorrhaging money and looking for more. So a group, including Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, is gathering today in Washington to talk about what the government needs to do going forward. Chris Mayer is professor of real estate at New York's Columbia University. He's with us live from France, where he was kind enough to take our call this morning. Hi, Professor.
Hey, how you doing?
I should say bonjour. So now, should the government be in the mortgage business?
Well, I think there is a role for the government to play, but it is a much, much smaller role than the government has played so far. And certainly, you know, today the government is making more than 19 out of every 20 mortgages. Even historically, they've been doing 60%. I'd love to see the government's role sort of taper down to less than half that over time.
What do you think, Professor, can be done with Fannie and Freddie? And I know the Treasury Secretary Geithner says there's no going back to the old days before the housing crisis for both of them. I mean, what should happen?
Well, I think it's easy to say there's no going back, but, you know, the question is, where is forward? The forward part, I think, I hope, is a role where the government is taking on much less risk than they have in the past, although that's not what many of the proposals are saying. And I think the government should really be focused on places where the housing market doesn't work. And that might be helping some people save for down payments, find some role there. And I think at times when the market isn't working, there's a role for the government to step in and help. But certainly during heady times when everybody could be getting a mortgage, 2005, 2006, 2007, there shouldn't have been a role for Fannie and Freddie to take on what they did.
Do you think they go away?
No, I think it's going to be hard to get rid of them anytime soon. Even if we don't have institutions called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, we're certainly going to have the government play a role in housing in the future. If for no other reason, it's too tempting for politicians. But I'm not sure that's the best answer from a policy perspective.
There you go. All right. Well, Professor Chris Mayer, professor of real estate at New York's Columbia University, we do thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You got it.
And for more on the government's role in the housing market, we turn to our Tuesday regular analyst, Julie Neiman at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Hi, Julie.
Morning, Bill.
Well, the government can't seem to encourage home ownership and keep credit markets moving and protect taxpayers. What's the answer?
Well, it's an impossible task, but today Tim the Toolman will give it a positive spin. He's going to talk about how important housing is to the economy, the American dream more affordable than ever before with prices plunging, interest rates at record low, it's time to buy. But yes, but their big task now has to be reform Fannie and Freddie. They're still issuing very poor quality loans, but they're doing it just to keep things going. But it's pushing more bad debt down the road, and we can see this coming. Former Fed Governor William Poole says, shut them down. The government doesn't belong in housing anyway, and we can have an orderly exit. But the problem is, right now, they're the only ones lending, so he's got a tough road ahead of him.
So would being stricter on Fannie and Freddie, what would that do to home prices that are already beat up?
Well, we're still going to see home prices starting to decline, but for a different reason. Bank of International Settlements, they're the central bank for the 53 worldwide largest banks, says the future of housing globally is not good. We're going to see prices drop 30 to 50% over the next 40 years, and it's because of demographics. Last 20 years, young people were buying houses. Prices went up. Next 20 years, old people are retiring, living off of their assets. They're going to be selling prices, and prices will go down. Now, the U.S. isn't as bad as the rest of the world. We still have a high birth rate and immigration, but we're a secular trend, housing prices down.
Very interesting. Julie Neiman, Smith Moore & Company, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Today, the Federal Reserve told us industrial production rose a bit in July. One of the factors, an East Coast heat wave kept utilities pumping out power for air conditioners. Heat waves are always in part a financial story because the people they hurt the most are generally the ones who can't afford to escape the heat. Author Edward P. Cohn has written about the economics and politics of heat waves in a new book called Hot Time in the Old Town. Edward, welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you very much.
You chronicle the heat wave of 1896, which killed more than 1,000 people. It also helped a young Teddy Roosevelt become president because he stood up and said being poor in New York City shouldn't be a death sentence.
That's right. There was actually an ICE trust established in the city, and Roosevelt set about trying to bust the trust by giving away free ICE to the poor of the Lower East Side.
And it was the poor that really got hit by these temperatures, right?
Absolutely. The average victim was a working-age male manual laborer, an immigrant probably living in the tenement, and the tenement itself was the last nail in the coffin for hundreds of New Yorkers.
Paint a picture for us of how the poor were living, especially living through those temperatures and humidity.
Yeah, that's right. It's not just that there wasn't, of course, air conditioning or electric refrigeration. The living and working conditions were so different 100 years ago. Most New Yorkers, of course, weren't stockbrokers and lawyers. They were manual laborers working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and going home to their stifling, suffocating, squalid tenements where during the heat wave, the temperature could easily reach 120 degrees, like living inside a pizza oven.
Let's forward to today, Edward. We still have heat waves, obviously. How far have we come in protecting the poorest people?
I don't think we've come very far. Look at the 1995 Chicago heat wave, killed 700 people. Look what's happening in Russia and Moscow now. We hear a lot from Russia about the fires, and we see the dramatic images of the smoke. We tend to forget that heat still remains today the number one natural disaster killer in the United States.
The book is Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. Edward P. Cohn, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 17th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us right here in the United States. The U.S. Justice Department is stepping up its probes into big global banks, banks that have ties to countries that aren't so friendly with the United States, Cuba, Iran, Libya. The giant British bank Barclays is the latest to settle on the issue of handling secret transactions with those countries, agreeing to pay $300 million in fines. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us live to talk about those fines. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Steve.
How much do we know about this case?
Barclays has admitted funneling up to $500 million into the U.S. banking system from banks in prohibited countries, such as the ones you mentioned, countries against which the U.S. or the international community have applied sanctions.
Did the bank, Stephen, know where the money was coming from?
Yes. The Department of Justice accused Barclays of knowingly and willfully breaking sanctions, and the bank has accepted that. It's agreed to pay this fine of $300 million and to tighten its procedures. Barclays, by the way, is very keen to keep in with the U.S. authorities. Remember, it bought a big chunk of Lehman Brothers, and Barclays is now trying to establish a major presence on Wall Street.
Yeah, I remember that. Now, I'm curious, Stephen, how many other banks have been caught doing this?
Well, this certainly isn't the first. I mean, we've had Lloyds, another British bank, and also the Swiss bank Credit Suisse have both paid hefty sums to settle similar claims. Richard Hunter is with stockbrokers Hargreaves Lansdown. He says this is all a result of the much closer attention the U.S. pays to international banking transactions following 9/11, and there could be more cases in the pipeline.
In general terms, there has been a coordinated global effort to put a lid on terrorism, particularly through the financial system. So on that basis, we could expect some more to come.
And especially if the transactions involve Iran. Analysts say Iran, because of its nuclear ambitions, is now the main focus of U.S. scrutiny.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
We've been talking about skyrocketing prices in global commodities lately, and cotton is the latest to see its prices jump. It all comes down to supply, demand, and global natural disasters. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Floods and landslides damaged the supply of cotton coming from China, the world's largest cotton producer. And the horrific floods in Pakistan destroyed about a third of that country's crop. Global inventories are running low. At the same time, consumers in China and India are buying more clothes, so demand for cotton is rising.
The mills are scrambling, trying to find supplies, and that pipeline is empty right now.
That's independent cotton analyst Mike Stevens. He says supplies will remain tight until the harvest in October.
This is going to be a good year for cotton farmers in the United States.
But it's not such a good year for manufacturers. For companies like Hanes and Levi Strauss, higher cotton prices add up to millions of dollars in extra expenses. Stevens says apparel companies will pass along those higher costs.
Our days are numbered as far as cheap clothes.
He expects retail prices for clothing will get more expensive just in time for the holiday shopping season. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Tuesday, August 17th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers, marketplace.org. When you think New York taxicab, you might picture a white-knuckle ride in a death machine. But a new analysis of car crashes there shows a different picture. From the Marketplace Transportation Desk at WNYC, Colin Campbell tells us who New Yorkers should really be afraid of.
Khalid Mahmoud's yellow cab has paid his bills for the last 6 years, so he's not surprised that new data shows New York cabbies are rarely responsible for hitting people.
We don't want to lose our license, so we are very responsible driver, you know.
City transportation officials reported this week that cab drivers caused just 13% of crashes in which pedestrians are seriously hurt or killed. The data, 7,000 recent crashes, points to a new source, men. Male drivers are behind the wheel in 4 out of 5 of these kind of collisions, and they're most likely to be driving their own car, not a taxi, truck, or bus. Men are also most likely to be the ones hit. These injuries and deaths cost the New York economy about $1.4 billion a year in lost income. In New York, I'm Colin Campbell for Marketplace.
Ranchers in the West say cattle branding with a hot iron is still the best way to separate their livestock from their neighbors. In Colorado, branding is mandatory, and a rancher's brand is private property that can be bought and sold. And that's given rise to a lucrative market. Colorado Public Radio's Zachary Barr reports.
Ex-rancher Mark Allard's hanging out at the county fair. He's on one side of the fairgrounds, and clear on the other side are the cattle. And that's fine by him.
The only place I want to see a cow's on the plate.
After 50 years in the business, Allard decided to quit. He says it's too hard to make a living. He sold the ranch, but he's still got one thing up for sale, his cattle brand.
I had it since I was a kid. Kept it forever.
Allard hasn't yet found a buyer, but he has a good idea of what that buyer's name is.
You know, if your name's Al, it's real good.
Al is the brand. It's the letters A and L with a bar underneath, and it doesn't come cheap.
Oh, probably in the $3,000 to $4,000 range.
I'll give you $1,500.
No, not enough.
Allard's price is high because ranchers covet simple one- and two-letter brands. But those haven't been available for decades. In fact, finding anything that works can be tough. Around 33,000 unique brands are registered in Colorado. But a few weeks ago, it had even more. At his office, Brand Commissioner Rick Whaler opens a filing cabinet. It contains paperwork from 4,000 newly canceled brands.
See, like some of these, like this one was first recorded in 1950, and they just didn't pay the last assessment.
A 5-year assessment now costs $225. That's double what it was a few years ago. Whaler says that fee increase is causing people to give up brands they no longer need. But before you book a flight to Denver to start a career flipping cattle brands, you should know most of the recently canceled brands aren't so valuable.
This brand is stacked a quarter circle shed in water over a Z connected to a Lazy J down on the right.
In other words, it's no Al. In Denver, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
And finally, Lynn Rosenthal walked into a Manhattan Starbucks on Sunday and ordered a plain bagel. The barista's response was, "Would you like butter or cheese on that?"
Now, Rosenthal, who is an English professor, was not interested in a list of things she didn't want. So she simply stated, "Plain bagel." Now, the barista refused to serve her, and according to the New York Post, police were called.
Rosenthal says Starbucks terminology is stupid, and she blames the barista for turning the dispute into a big deal. Not a grande deal.
Mm-mm.
Steve.
Mm-mm.
Okay, not a venti deal.
Not a venti
just
deal.
A plain big deal.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.